So today I want to talk to you. Nadine probably properly introduced us. I sort of went around looking for a place where we commonly would make a measurement that we would filter the effluent, where we'd filter something through a 0.45 micron filter, and then we would call the rest of that dissolved, and that these measurements maybe have been made for, you know, years, decades, and to start asking the question, is this really the case? Are we missing something here? Is there more nanoparticle-bound metals, or in this case, phosphorus, than we might predict? And I think phosphorus is a good place to do that, or a good element to use to look at that. And so this is a study that was conducted on some grassland pastures in Georgia. And as many of you are probably aware, the poultry industry produces a lot of chickens. That also means they produce a lot of chicken litter. And about 13 million megatons of litter are generated, and about 90% of that is applied to grasslands as fertilizer. It's primarily a mixture of manure from the broilers and sawdust and a few feathers and a little bit of soil. When they scrape the chicken houses out, they tend to get a little bit of whatever the bottom soil is that's present. Typically, pH is a slightly acidic, usually about 30 grams of nitrogen per kilogram and about 12 grams of phosphorus. And interestingly, a lot of that tends to be or is characterized as dissolved reactive phosphorus, which is typically filtered through a 0.45 micron filter. And so this is a experiment field site that was set up in 1995, I think. So it's been active about 15 years. And these are large plots. They're about 0.8 hectares, tall fescue and Bermuda grass. And they've been receiving 2.5 megagrams of litter per hectare in the spring and fall of each year. And in conjunction with this study, and why I'll make a point why I think this was an interesting place to start to look at this, they have three of those fields are aerated, and three are not aerated. And the aeration is done using, they're running some knives through the fields. And then the idea is that, and it's been shown in a lot of different places, if you do this to a grassland field that, for instance, has potential problems for runoff losses of nutrients, that this will oftentimes reduce both the runoff volume and also the quantity or the load, if you will, of nutrients. And one of the maybe unique aspects of this particular study is that it has a variety of different soil types. And so the study has been designed so that there are paired fields. So for instance, field one and field two are paired together. One of them is aerated, one is not. Field three and six are paired, and then four and five. So field two, five, and six are aerated. And this Sedgefield soil, which is shown here, is tends to be poorly drained soil. And these Cecil soils are generally considered well-drained. And so what was done, and this was work that was published in 2007 by Franklin et al., and what they found, and actually I was trying to summarize this graph as best I could, but it's actually a difficult graph to talk about, and I didn't want to totally change their data. So bear with me as you watch what I'm going to show you, is that in the well-drained soils, and this was consistent with what people saw in the past, that if before they began the aeration process, this was the slope. So this would be field two, or the one that's aerated on this side, and this is the unaerated field. And so if the slope decreases, right, if it goes down, that means by aerating the soil, we're improving we're getting less loss of phosphorus. And so you can see that that's what's taking place on these well-drained soils. But for the poorly drained soils, that wasn't what was observed. And the middle plot that I didn't show you, that was sort of intermediate between the two. And so what the authors came away and why I sort of got interested in it is that in these poorly drained soils, it appears that aeration is maybe doing something different, or it's certainly not having the desired effect. Why might that be? And what was proposed is that there's maybe aeration up at the top of the field is causing water to flow down, hitting an impermeable layer beneath poorly drained fields is closer to the surface, and then that's causing sort of a more of a through flow through the soil profile, perhaps gathering up phosphorus that is bound to soil iron oxides, for instance, that might be reduced when in this poorly drained field. So one of the things I thought is that, you know, this is, it's true that you can release, and I'll show you data that shows that this is the case, when you reduce an iron oxide that has a bunch of phosphorus stuck on the outside of it, that a lot of that phosphorus will be released. But it's also possible that through that reduction step, you can also mobilize colloids or nanoparticles. And there's two ways that I considered that this might take place. If you have a iron oxide cement that's holding these particles together, when that's dissolved, those particles then can be dispersed. And then as well, many of you probably are aware of this, that if you take a soil and subject it to anoxic conditions, it starts to undergo a reductive dissolution of iron and manganese oxides, that will oftentimes cause a pH to increase, sometimes up to a whole pH unit. And that change in pH can cause dispersion of those nanoparticles. And so this is another sort of indirect route that they could be mobilizing phosphorus-bound nanoparticles. And so for this study, the overall question that we were asking was, does nanoparticle-bound phosphorus contribute to this 0.45 micron filtered dissolved reactive phosphorus? And we set out to measure the composition of the soils and the runoff samples. And we have mostly data today that I'm going to talk about from the soils, different treatments that we've done to the soils, and some preliminary runoff data. Our two approaches were that we were going to take the soil and, I mean, we can measure the runoff, and we're doing that. But we can also take a look at the soil and try to assess what the potential is for mobilization of these nanoparticles. And we did that by simply doing an oxic incubation, just a water extract, basically, subjecting those to anoxic conditions for a week, and then also raising the pH. So in other words, trying to probe these two conditions that might generate dispersion of nanoparticles. And so don't pay too much attention to all the text. I apologize for that. But just in briefly, what we set out to do was to do an oxic water extraction, an anoxic incubation where we subjected the soils for 1 week under anoxic conditions. And then we also added a carbon source, some lactate. And then we paired that with a base addition that was similar in magnitude to what we observed in our anoxic treatments. And then also a base addition where we had the lactate added, because that changes the ionic strength quite a bit when you add a bunch of sodium lactate. And then we examined those using a differential centrifugation technique and then field flow fractionation coupled to ICP mass spec. And then we also have been doing the same thing on runoff that's collected at these outfalls. And I think I'll show you some of that data in a moment. And so at first, are the results we have, and I realized as I listened to Michael Cella's talk, I thought, you know, okay, I'm putting this group here of nanoparticles, but surely there's probably nanoparticles here because this is less than 30 nanometers. So, but in general, when we take these data and we run them on the FFF, we see nanoparticles that are in the range of 100 to 200 nanometers. So the bulk signal, the biggest, largest signal we see is in this range in terms of the particulate mass. And so what we see is that across the fields, we have anywhere between 36 and 10% of the phosphorus that is simply dispersed in a dilute water extract is nanoparticles, and fairly large nanoparticles, but yet would still pass through a 0.45 micron filter. When we subject these soils to our incubations, so in these graphs, I'm showing for comparison the oxic treatment, which is simply a water extract, then when we've added base, and then when we've subjected it to an anoxic treatment. And you can see that, not surprising, maybe what you might have predicted is that there's a large increase in less than 30 nanometer phosphorus when we subjected these soils to anoxic incubation, and potentially a bit more particles that are less between 30 and 450. When we did the same treatments with lactate, we saw we see a large sort of when you add lactate to a soil, it causes a desorption of a lot of phosphorus. I'm not exactly sure. I haven't investigated this more than simply looking at this data, but I think it's rather interesting. And we certainly see when we add lactate and then incubate these soils under anoxic conditions that we get, in most cases, a large dispersion of phosphorus that is less than 30 nanometers. And in some cases, a lot of that is larger than 30 nanometers. So it's clear that we are in both sort of probably releasing a lot of dissolved or truly dissolved phosphate ions, but we are also releasing a lot of phosphorus nanoparticles or nanoparticle-bound phosphorus. When we take these samples and we subject them to field flow fractionation, and just briefly what this is very much like a size exclusion chromatography, but it's set up in a different way where you're less there's a lot less interaction, for instance, with the solid phase of the like would be in a size exclusion chromatography column. And so what you do is you run a flow. It's almost like a channel, like you're going down a river as a particle. If you're a large particle, right, you're flowing down the river, and there's a small, it's maintained a small flow of what's called a cross flow down through the bottom of the river, if you will. And if you're a large particle, you fall out, you sort of stick along the bottom. You don't move very as fast as if you're a smaller particle. You'll maintain a faster velocity. You'll get out the end of the channel faster, and then you'll be detected by the detector. So it's a pretty simple way of separating particles, and it tends to be its size separation range is between 0.5 and 800 nanometers. The nice thing is it's relatively easy to couple this with sort of downstream analysis. In this case, we've coupled it with ICP mass spec, and oftentimes these systems have a light scatter along with them. So you get a lot of information on one sample, and that's much better than using multiple samples that you assume are the same. So I'll just show you one that in general, this is what the nanoparticles that we dispersed in our soil treatments look like. This one is from plot 3 when we added a little bit of base. You get this very similar type particles on all the other treatments. It appears to be an aluminosilicate particle with a fair amount of iron. This is a log scale, and a small amount of phosphorus sorbed to it. The size range from our multi-angle light scatter is somewhere, so this is the radius, somewhere in between, it predicts it about 120 or so. When we take this over to a zeta sizer, we get a particle size of about 220 nanometers. Those are fairly good agreement, so I think that's probably true, and these particles are negatively charged. When we've done the same thing with the runoff samples, we unfortunately have been using, so the runoff samples are collected in the field, and there's a lot of other analyses. There's collaborators that do work on this project, and so when we took a look at the runoff samples that we've taken a look at, were 3 months after the application of litter, we found only 4% of those part of that phosphorus was in this 450 to less than 30 nanoparticle range. When we run this on the FFF, we see that we don't see any silica in these particles. We see it's primarily probably an aluminum oxide or maybe an aluminum iron mixed oxide, right? And very little phosphorus. This is probably just at the detection limit for the FFF that we can see a change in that phosphate peak. And when we've ran the runoff samples from 6 months after the application, we don't get we aren't able to detect them in sort of this relatively crude method. I think what we are now set up to do is they're about to add litter to this field in mid-November, and I think then there's potential for a lot more mobile, but there's the potential for mobilization of these nanoparticles is a lot higher earlier on in the litter application process. So in summary, Nanoparticle phosphorus is present in all these study soils in general. There's a lot of these aluminosilicates, which are in 200 nanometers. This is the largest, so there's probably a lot of other nanoparticles that are smaller, but this is the largest, this is the biggest signal that might be missed, for instance, by a 0.45 micron filtration. And anoxic conditions tend to increase the amount of these nanoparticles that are dispersed. And then in general, we see very low baseline nanoparticle phosphorus load in the runoff after 300 nanometers. And the particles are tend to be a little bit different. So thank you very much. I'll take any questions. How do I sit? One more. How do I define the? What do I think the mechanism of binding is? Is that what you're asking? What I think the mechanism of binding is of the phosphorus is?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I can't make any comment on that because we didn't. We haven't looked at it at that level. We see that they're associated. Could be co-precipitated. Could be surface absorbed. Certainly, the data from the addition of lactate and then an immediate measurement, we see a lot of phosphorus released. That seems to indicate that there's probably, that looks like a desorption reaction to me rather than a dissolution. So I would probably think a lot of that phosphate is sorbed to the surface of these nanoparticles, but I can't say for sure. So,
Given your observation of the lactate effect on creating more of these nanoparticles, do you see the lactate or something like dissolved organic carbon playing a role in affecting the transport of phosphorus in the form of these nanoparticles, and in what way?
Well, I think that, I think don't misinterpret what I said about the lactate tends to sort of release this what is more or less dissolved phosphorus. At least that's what the data is suggesting. I don't see that big peak in the particulates unless we incubate it under anoxic conditions with lactate. Then we see it. But I think these particles are likely mineral organic complexes. Certainly there's a lot of, in other work that I've done, I found that these particles in the same size range were really, in many cases, they had a lot of bimolar ratio. They were mostly carbon. So, I think that in general we're looking at probably carbon-based nanoparticle or carbon-associated nanoparticles. But I can't comment on, like, for instance, if you increase the organic matter in soil, how that would impact like nanoparticle release. That would be interesting, though.
But the implication.
That's what I would assume, but we don't have data to really support that strongly at this point.
Yeah. But your phosphorus bound to the particle is low.
Yes. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yep. Oh. Is that it?
Yeah.
Okay.
I assume your systems, your setups were not sterilized.
Yes. So in terms of the reductive dissolution, is that what you're mentioning? I think that in general, what I've found in the past is you just don't get any, we could use a platinum catalyst, for instance, into hydrogen atmosphere to generate some reductive dissolution, but you're talking about.
So you're seeing that abiotic
system, so you want to see. Well, no, for instance, the oxic dispersion, I think you would see the same thing if you added in mercuric chloride or something to keep the bugs from. I mean, those are only 1 hour extractions. Do you know what I mean?
I'm asking that because another hypothesis could be with lactase, the way it stimulates bacteria.
Yes, I think we are, especially in the anoxic treatments. That's all biologically reductive dissolution, I would guess.
Okay.